Only member of our committee.
And the
The Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. Welcome. It is Thursday, April 9th. Senator Olson, I was just telling him he's always the most timely member of our committee. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 722 and invite Senator Hansel and Nicole Palmateer Hazelbaker. And will you summarize briefly?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 722 appropriates general fund dollars to the Department of Human Services for Oregon Project Independence, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. Senator Hansel, welcome.
Thank you. Senator Gilsel, Chair, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, Senator from District 29. I'm here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 722. It is intended to highlight the importance of fully funding Oregon's Project Independence. Past sessions have seen discussions about cutting this program, but with the many benefits the Oregon Project Independence deserves, this program, it deserves the legislature's full and enthusiastic support for the program. Senate Bill 722 is an opportunity for us to talk about maintaining current funding levels and, if anything, perhaps expanding the program. OPI is a program providing a variety of services to Oregonians age 60 and older who do not receive most Medicaid services. These services are intended to support their independence and allow them to remain in their home for as long as they wish. To qualify for OPI, a person must be age 60 or older and need some type of in-home assistance based on an assessment done by an NWSDS case manager. Persons younger than age 60 who have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or some other dementia may be eligible for OPI services. So what type of services may be available through this? Personal care, in-home services, homemaker assistance such as preparing meals, chore assistant, home-delivered meals, case management, information assistant, outreach involvement, respite, interpreting, translation, and money management. Oregon Project Independence gives clients who are over the federal poverty level assistance in their homes while keeping them off Medicaid Title 19. The expansion of the Oregon Project Independence would aid in helping the elderly population of the future maintain their independence without substantial additional funding from Medicaid. I urge your support and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you. Chair Gilster, members of the committee, for the record, Nicole Palmateer Hazelbaker here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and currently attempting to have the longest last name here in the building. Area Agencies on Aging by statute are the administrators of Oregon Project Independence, and we appreciate Senator Hansel's support of the program, and really all of you have been tremendously supportive of this program. I will just speak very briefly about OPI. OPI started in the 1970s, and the idea was that if you offer a little bit of assistance to individuals who are most highly at risk for unnecessary or premature entrance into the entitlement programs or into a higher level of care in a facility, that maybe you can help them stay independent and stay in their own homes. They are a small amount of help that's given. It is not intended to be a fully fleshed out care plan like you would see under the Medicaid program. That's not the intent or purpose. It's intended to be just that small amount of help, as the Senator pointed out, in personal care, housekeeping, those kinds of assistance that helps them to remain in independent. An individual who is on OPI cannot be receiving services under Medicaid or under the Oregon Health Plan. And as I'm sure you're all aware, Medicaid long-term care services also comes with the Oregon Health Plan benefit. An OPI client cannot be receiving either of those. Currently, our per-client average is between $300 and $350 per month. Medicaid is approximately six times higher in cost to serve an individual than that. The majority of OPI clients have a service priority level that would be within Medicaid eligibility criteria, and their income would also qualify them for Medicaid should they have chosen to go to that program. In this last biennium, we did have a substantial increase in the program, and because of that, we've served at this point in the game over 4,000 seniors under OPI, which is really a record-setting number. However, even with that expansion, we still have wait lists around the state, which is always very, very humbling to all of us. clients are avoiding higher costs through this program, and we are also saving the budget significant costs. Also in this most recent biennium, we had a small amount of funding that was directed towards serving younger people with physical disabilities, and we have been able to start that pilot in 5 areas around the state. We're serving close to 300 individuals, having started that program in fall of 2014. It's our first opportunity to look at what OPI can do for this particular population. Within the individuals that we are serving under this pilot, we do have some individuals who have an intellectual disability if they also have physical issues that would qualify them for the program. What we most seek for OPI is stability. In the past, and I know a lot of you have been fighting that fight with us, we've seen the program go up and down, and with that, we've had to cut clients and bring them back, and cut clients and bring them back, and we hope that we can stop that pattern. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and we appreciate all of your support for Project Independence.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you both for bringing this forward. I think we all agree that Project Independence is incredibly important. We really want to be able to support people to age in place. It's not just cost effective, but it's the right thing to do for people to be able to be where they want to be. So thank you very much. And is there anybody else that would like to be heard on this bill? Nope, seeing none, I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 722 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 767. Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 767 appropriates $5 million general fund dollars to the Department of Human Services for domestic violence programs, declares an emergency effective on passage, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Is there anyone here that would like to, I don't have anybody signed up, but is there anybody that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 767? Once and twice. All right. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 767. We are going to jump to the back of the page, to the second page, to the tax credit bills that need to go to joint.
Just as a comment,
yeah.
There was another bill that appropriated money for domestic violence programs, so this one really isn't needed.
Duplicative.
Yeah, it is duplicative, and I know it's already been passed out and sent down to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. So we heard on a couple of different days a variety of bills on tax credits. Several of them don't need to be amended. In this package is not the tax credit, the crop-related tax credit that included the word processing. But we can move Senate Bill 40, which is the tax credit for a child with a disability. When you put this way, we can do that all in mass, or you're just saying do it the same way on each one?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if the committee is inclined and there's not going to be an objection that you want to note on a particular record and the record's going to be duplicative on all of them, yes, you can do it as one motion.
So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We can do them all in one motion, or we can do them separately. What is the pleasure of the committee?
I like to do them separately. If we
all
go
right.
Really fast because I have notes on each
okay,
one,
let's do it that way then.
And Madam Chair, can I just ask a question? So some of these, I think, or maybe all of the tax credits that came out of agencies, they're identical versions in the House and the Senate, right? And so they'll both go to the joint committee,
yes.
And then the committee sort of sorts it out.
That's correct. And I did check with the folks at Tax Credits to find out, do you want them moved from just one committee or the other committee? But they wanted them to come from both, which shows that the policy committees on both sides have had a conversation or a hearing about the policy and had the chance to have the policy conversation. Because once it gets to tax credits, they'll just be talking about the money portion of it. So they prefer to have them, they'll have a series of duplicative bills and tax credits. They'll have both the House and the Senate vehicles when they get there. Some of them may not match up. For instance, I'm not sure what's happening with the crop credit on the other side. Yeah. So with that, I'm going to open up, I'm not going to open up a tax credit, but I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 40. Cheyenne?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 40 is the extension on the tax credit for child with disability. It was previously heard on March 19th, has a subsequent referral, of course, to tax credits, has a light revenue because of that, and a no fiscal.
Great. Senator Olson?
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 40 to the floor where they do pass recommendation that the bills be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 40 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Just a comment that this is really highly used. It's been doubling from 2005 to 2012 from about $2.6 million to over $5 million. For those who have children with disabilities, I think it's a really important tax credit. Sort of want that on the record. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Senator. Any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes, and the bill goes on to tax credits. So I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 40 and open a work session on Senate Bill 41.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 41 was previously heard on March 3rd. This is the one that extends the credit for elderly or permanently and totally disabled. It has, again, a light revenue and no fiscal.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 41 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bills be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 41 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Just a comment again, Madam Chair. The number of people here has grown from 2005 to 2012 from 28,000 Oregonians to over 40,000. Again, a tax credit that a tax credit for the elderly or permanently disabled, it's highly used. So that's just wanted to comment that Oregonians need this. Thank you.
And I appreciate that. I think it's really helpful to have you put these pieces on the record. So thank you for that, Senator. Any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes, and Senate Bill 41 heads to tax credits. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 41, open a work session on Senate Bill 43.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 43 extends the additional personal exemption credit for severe disability. Again, this was heard on March 19th, as a light revenue and no fiscal.
Thank you. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 43 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bills be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 43 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there discussion? Senator Monis-Anderson.
Number of claimants, 28,000 to 40,000 on the severe disability. I might have mixed up my number. No, that's true. Yeah.
Thank you. We've got a routine going here now.
Okay, that's all. Just again, I think it goes to $7.4 million.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 43 and open a work session on Senate Bill 48.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 48 extends the tax credit for employer-provided dependent care assistance, a light revenue, no fiscal, and a subsequent referral to tax credits, previously heard on March 19th.
Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 48 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Pardon me. Every time I'd read that, she'd put her hand in front of it, and I couldn't see what she'd...
Oh, sorry.
And that the bills be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
I was just crossing out the numbers.
Yeah,
so we
she'd
keep
cross
track
them out. I couldn't
are.
See.
Do you think that you can make it with no recommendation? This tax credit is primarily used by corporations, which have historically accounted for roughly 75% of all the credits. And this would allow the revenue to really to look at it. The credit equals, it's going downward. People aren't really using it very much anymore. And I don't have enough knowledge on these tax credits to really know if I would hate to, have an employer who really did need it not to be able to use it. But we don't have that information.
Would you be willing to revise your recommendation?
Well, if you look at the revenue impact statement, it says that it is going down from 0.3 to 0.14. Sure, if that's what everybody wants.
Madam Chair, I think that on the House side, some work is being done on this as well. So, I mean, I think if we just pass it over, then the two bills will be looked at together.
So what if we do this? Since we have questions, would you be willing to withdraw your motion? We'll hold this over. I'll check in with the chair on the other side.
Oh, no, still pass it out.
But just do it without recommendation.
Yeah, just do it without recommendation, because I just don't have enough information. If, you know, who are these employers? They get the credit equals 50% of the eligible cost paid up to $2,500 per employee, and it's large corporations primarily that is using them, but we don't have access to that real information. So still pass it out. We don't need to do anything.
So, and it actually, the use of it is growing in a revenue impact statement. The negative number, the more negative it gets, that's the bigger it gets. So it's so if it goes from, you know, $900,000 to $1.4 million, so the revenue impact is how much is the state spending on sending these back. So it's increasing in use.
That's not what the from the revenue office, I don't think he's here. It has ranged from 0.2 million in 2011 to 1.4 million in 2005. Its use declined prior to the economy slipping. But
I think I would feel better if we held it over for till Tuesday. So would you be willing to withdraw your? So we can just get our answers done.
Sure.
We have time.
It says in here the use of the tax credit by corporations did increase in 2012, but it's not clear if growth will continue in subsequent years. The estimates provided here are based on the assumption that average growth rates will continue. We can or send it down without recommendation if it's going to be worked on both sides.
I would just feel better if I could double check the information before we send it out.
Chair Gilster, I remove my
motion.
On Senate Bill 48.
Do I have to ask for objections to the removal of the motion, or does he just get to decide that on his own?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. To be safe, you might.
Okay, does anybody object to the good senator withdrawing his motion?
That's what I want. Instead of remove, I should say withdraw my motion.
Withdraw.
I endorse that.
I don't have to gavel that, do I?
No, Madam Chair, and if you want to carry over.
And I do want to carry it over to our next meeting, to Tuesday.
Actually, Madam Chair, you could have left the motion in place and just closed the work session.
Okay. This is a new one.
Can.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I've not gone through this before.
There's Chris right there. Let's bring him up.
Chris, come on up.
Your work session is still open?
Our work session is still open.
But
is this being used more or less?
Yeah, wrong room at the wrong.
It is more. It is more.
Committee, we're talking about Senate Bill 48, extending tax credit for the employer-provided dependent care assistance.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And that's a good question. up through 2011, it did have this kind of up and down motion, but generally downward. In 2012, which the Department of Revenue just released tax credit information, so I was able to incorporate that latest data point, if you will, in the revenue impact statement. So in 2012, it kind of popped back up. And at this point, I'm not sure what it's going to be looking like going forward. Again, that's all wrapped up in these being light statements, but it was kind of an outlier in terms of the use of the credit, so I included it here. And I think some of the information before was the tax credit report that I produced or released at the beginning of session. So this
February 2015, yes.
Yes. So the latest information is a little contradictory to past information, which is, I think, the source of the confusion.
Okay.
And so we have one data point that kind of popped it back up.
Okay.
And so I'm still looking at it, and I'm not sure what information I'll be able to find about projections moving forward.
And when you said, Madam Chair, that it was primarily corporations that used it, are these small employers or large employers, or do you know?
Chair Gelser, Senator Mona Sanderson, I don't know off the top of my head if they were large or small. And even the definition of large or small depends on which metric you want to use, and employees or gross receipts or the like. So it's on the surface, it's not necessarily a quick question to get an answer to. This is one where it's about a dozen corporations that tend to claim it, and then you have about 75 or so taxpayers on the personal side. Now, they'll be claiming it because they're employers, but those could be collectively anywhere from one to 75 S-corps or partnerships.
Thank you.
And I'd say, Madam Chair, that an S-corp could be any size in the world, so...
Yes, there. That's a good point. There is this perception that an S-corp is a small business, but that is not necessarily correct.
Yeah. C-corps are dinosaurs at this point, so...
In talking with some CPAs, I get some interesting comments about why C-corps exist. I mean, other than publicly funding. I'm not publicly funding, selling shares.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot. My farm is a C-corp because at the time we incorporated, it was all that existed. And the transition is cumbersome. So,
yes.
Yeah.
There, no.
All right, go ahead.
No, I was just going down a C-corp discussion.
Now, let's skip the C-corp discussion for now. We can save that for the Revenue Committee. But... Senator Dembro indicated that the House might be doing some work on this similar vehicle on the other side. Are you aware of?
To my knowledge, it will not be going to JTACs on the House side.
Oh, really? Okay.
I don't know that for certain, but that's my understanding.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Any further questions for Chris? Seeing none. So we're going to carry this over till Tuesday. And with that, I'm going to close the work session. Does anybody object to Senator Olson's objection of withdrawal of the motion? Seeing no objection, you have withdrawn. And we're closing the work session on Senate Bill 48. And we're jumping ahead to Senate Bill 50. Opening a work session on Senate Bill 50.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 50 is one of the two individual development account extensions. This one extends the credit for donations to individual development accounts previously heard on March 5th. It has a light revenue, no fiscal, and, of course, a referral to tax credits.
All right. Senator Olson. Sorry. And I will not touch this when you start.
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 50 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 50 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. And both this one and Senate Bill 51, there is some other work that's going on in the Senate around the individual development accounts. I think you'll remember we had a pretty compelling hearing on these bills and around the power of these accounts and the great work that's being done across the state to help build assets for people and help them gain more independence. Is there any further discussion on
No, I'm just surprised that not many people are using it. For the 2013-15 biennium, roughly $13,000 was dedicated to these costs. Is that still...
Welcome back, Chris.
Those are administrative costs.
$13 million.
That's administrative costs, but I don't see how much is actually...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. This is the IDA withdrawal.
The contribution.
The contribution or the withdrawal?
The contribution.
The, I can't recall, I tried to indicate on the statement how many people were claiming it, but this is the one where there's a program cap of $500,000 of tax credits. So people will make a contribution to the nonprofit that administers these for matching funds, basically for the IDA accounts, and they get a 75% tax credit.
Oh yes.
I only raised my hand because I'm reading your thing. It said the program has been administered with a cap of $7.5 million in tax credits. Are we in the same one? Are we in 50 or 51?
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair,
this is a problem without my notes.
Bill 50, and I can repeat some of the background information.
It was the
staff measure summary.
Sure.
Members of the committee, between 2000, and these are lifted directly from Mr. Allenack's report.
Okay.
Between 2008-2013, on the background for the staff measure summary, the number of participants grew from 916 to 4,210.
Okay.
During that time,
yeah,
roughly $13.1 million in matching funds have been provided to 2,524 program graduates who saved roughly $4.6 million. And the program graduates saved, on average, $1,849 over 23 months and benefited from an average match of $5,205.
Excellent. That was very well written.
It's a very thorough report, Madam Chair.
But in what I just said, I officially mixed and matched tax credits. I was referring to a child care tax credit. The $7.5 million is the contributions for the IDA.
Oh, that's great.
And the cap is not in statute, but that's how it's been administered, for a $10 million cap on contributions. The $10 million times the 75% tax credit is the $7.5 million.
Thank you very much. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. You might stick around for a minute, Chris.
Okay, one more.
Closing the work session on Senate Bill 50. And I do want to compliment you for just magically appearing at the moment that we needed you. You're really good at that. I'm now going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 51, which is the withdrawals.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. Senate Bill 51 extends the tax credit for qualified withdrawals from ID accounts. It's also heard previously on March 5th, has a light revenue, no fiscal, and a referral to tax credits.
And again, before a motion made, maybe I should. It says the amount of the credit is the lesser of the withdrawal, usual and reasonable closing costs are $2,000. And I can't tell from here, and maybe from your notes again, how many people actually used it.
I don't believe there were that many that use it. It's for a specific use of the IDA accounts. It's for the purchase of a home. People can use the IDA accounts for a number of things. So it's for one particular kind of use that the credit exists.
There were, Madam Chair, members of the committee, percentages cited in Mr. Allenack's report. Usage to buy a house was 32% of participants. For education, 37%. Starting a business, 27%. Those are the goals that the accounts are set up to achieve. So there is a certain breakdown there. It's the same
number
of participants.
So it looks like it's being used.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 51 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 51 to the floor with do pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, and it heads to tax credits. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 51 and open a work session on Senate Bill 49.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you may recall Senate Bill 49 and Senate Bill 212, which will also be up possibly for consideration today. They are both extending the sunset on the tax credit for contributions to the Office of Child Care. Senate Bill 212 actually expands the program. Senate Bill 49 is the bare extension of the sunset. It was heard on March 3rd. A fiscal statement has issued, a revenue light, and it has the referral to tax credits, of course.
And just as a question to both of you, if we sent just Senate Bill 49, when tax credits looks at the budget and what you have available for tax credits, under the relating clause of Senate Bill 49, you could still expand the program?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And that, colleagues, was my intention, was to send that down there with the renewal and allow that conversation about extensions to move into the cost of the tax credit. So we would be moving 49, but not 212. I wanted them both here to make sure that there was the ability to do that. Should joint tax credits choose to do so. Is that okay with those?
The
way in the back.
Way in the back. Oh, please, sure. Come up, David.
the House side.
Go ahead, Chris.
The House side, I think, is looking at adopting a policy similar to 212.
Okay.
Chair Gelser, for the record, David Mandel, Policy Director, Early Learning Division. There is some actually policy changes that are also part of SB 212 that change some of that redirect the allowable uses a little bit to be more in conform with how the tax credit is currently used. So there is actually some substantive difference between 212 and 49 beyond the extension of the sunset.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. We shall move them both then. Thank you. All right, Senator Olson.
So you want to do both of them together?
No.
All right. Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 49 to the floor where they do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 49 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there discussion?
I just have a question. So if 212 makes necessary changes, why would we send 49 down? You know, they can always scale it back, it seems to me, if they scale back the dollar amount. Well, I mean, that might be easier, actually.
Right. I think the point, my intention of setting them both down would be, I think having served on JTACs before, what was challenging is that you're working with a limited pot. So I would want to be careful that the policy committee, by sending the bigger one, isn't recommending that we're prioritizing above all of the other credits this one for an expansion and the others for not. But if it has, if that's the one that has the policy changes, I want to make sure the policy changes go there. But by sending both, we're indicating that we think it's an important policy to continue, but we aren't necessarily prioritizing the expansion of this tax credit above other tax credits. And that's the kind of discussion that we had in JTACs as we tried to figure out what it was that the policy committees had done as they had sent things forward. So if we send the, so in summary, if we send the expansion but not the one that maintains it, I'm afraid that that may prioritize this to a higher level than what we intend compared to all of the others that we're sending over and the others that are coming from other policy committees. Is that?
Yes, that answers it.
Great. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to Senate Bill 49 going on to the Tax Credits Committee? Right, so ordered, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 49 and open a work session on Senate Bill 212.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 212 extends the sunset on the contributions to Office of Child Care and makes the following additional changes. It increases the annual limit on the amount of the credit from $500,000 to $2.5 million, removes the requirement to select and use tax credit marketer, removes requirement to select and distribute monies to community agency, requires distributions to child care providers according to rules adopted by the Early Learning Council, and applies to tax years beginning on or after January 2016. Takes effect the 91st day after sine die. It was previously heard March 3rd, has a fiscal statement and a light revenue, and, of course, the referral to tax credits.
Thank you very much. Any further discussion on these? It's the same discussion we were just having.
Mm-hmm. I'll just say, Madam Chair, this is, you know, I think a really important program. And if we can find the money to expand it, I hope we can.
Good. Thank you very much. And with that, I am going to close.
Move it.
Oh, yes, please move the bill.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 212 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 212 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And I need to do one more check on Senate Bill 760, so I want to carry that over to Tuesday. So I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 760 and carrying over Senate Bill 760. This is the expansion of the crop donation to Tuesday, closing the work session on Senate Bill 760. And then opening the work session on Senate Bill 213.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 213 codifies the Early Learning Council's responsibility to develop funding. Forgive me, I won't describe what the measure does because the Dash 3 amendment is before the committee, and I believe a fiscal statement just issued and should be at the dais for everyone. There's no revenue impact on the Dash 3, and we will be seeking removal of the subsequent referral if the committee is inclined to move the bill with the Dash 3. The Dash 3 amendment requires a specified evaluation and report with recommendations to the legislature by February of 2019, plus an additional annual reporting requirement by September 15th of each year. It was previously heard on March 19th.
Thank you. And Senator Cruz, do you want to speak to your Dash 3 amendment? This is the early learning hubs.
Just briefly, if I could. Basically, one of the things we're looking at is the fact that education could be going, the system itself could be going through some major transitions over the next few years, and we wanted to have the ability at some point in the future to take a look at the early learning hubs, how they're structured, how they fit in, and So, and this is something we have done in other times, rather than have a hard sunset, what we have put in here is a point in time when the legislature is going to have to take a hard look at the program. So the basic difference is, rather than requiring affirmative action to continue, it would require affirmative action to move in a different direction, potentially. But I think, you know, Senator Roblin's got a work group that's dealing with OEIB and all of the things associated with that. And we will probably be seeing, I think, some significant legislation coming forward in the short session relative to that whole mix. So because the early learning hubs are part of that, we thought it was appropriate at a future date to be able to take a hard look at the structure. And so that's what the amendment allows.
And it doesn't put in a sunset, so it allows that confidence of continuity for
all
the
does,
hubs that
it
are
It does, but and like I said, it would require affirmative action by the Legislative Assembly to make any changes, which may or may not happen. We don't know at this point in time, but by doing it that way, it still puts responsibility upon the Legislative Assembly, but gives the folks in the interim a level of certainty that they will continue at least for 4 years at this point. So that is the agreement that we made with the governor's office. So I think we're good to go.
Well, Madam Chair, yes. We have the dash ones, twos, and threes. So which one are you talking about?
Threes.
Oh, okay.
So, Senator Olson, would you move the dash threes?
Would you?
Would you please?
Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 213, dated 3/30/2015.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 213, dated 3/30/2015. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 2013 as amended to the floor with a Senate Bill 213 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits be rescinded.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 213 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits be rescinded. Is there any discussion? I would just like to thank Senator Cruz for working with the Early Learning Council and the Governor's Office to get some amendments that were acceptable to you and to them. I don't know if you can all recall, we had the hearing at the end of the March 19th, and it was a pretty incredible hearing. We had the hearing room filled with people from all over the state. We heard from some remarkable families about the impact that these programs have had. I really think that the Early Learning Council and the early learning programs is one of the most important things we can be doing to address the problems we're talking about all across the building, whether it's addictions and mental health or education, outcomes, poverty, crime. If we can be providing families and kids with the supports that they need early on in their life, it's going to make a big difference. So I'm just want to say hats off to the Early Learning Council for the excellent work that's been done in these first years, and look forward to that continuing and starting to see the results of that work probably 10 and 15 years from now. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair. And to a large degree, this is a continuation of what the Commission on Children and Families was doing, and doing a marvelous job of. And one of my concerns is I don't want this to become completely education-focused, because it's family building and family unity is such a huge part of this. And so part of my concern was to make sure that we didn't lose the focus we had had while we add these other components. So,
very good. Any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, it will head to the floor, and if it's all right, I would like to carry this bill. So I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 213.
Madam Chair, you're the chair. You
you don't need to ask us.
All right. All right. So we've closed the work session on 213. Senator Shields. Maria will text him. All right, let's then, I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 659. And I'm going to carry that over again until Tuesday. We did get the amendments back that we wanted, but there was a brief error in them. What this bill is going to do is ensure that a kid with a significant medical need or disability is able to visit their non-custodial parent in Oregon and still have access to that in-home care. And this just creates the mechanism to enter into a contract with that other state's Medicaid. So they will be able to access the services here. If the child is visiting from Texas, Texas Medicaid will pay for it. All of those systems are in place, but it's not well known. And this just directs the department and the counties to help families be able to move through that process.
If you're Medicaid eligible, Madam Chair, it doesn't matter where you are, it crosses state lines.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is just clarifying that that's true for home and community-based service, waivered services as well. So that's going to be carried over to Tuesday when we will get the corrected amendment back. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 659. And I'm going to open, done that one. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 561 quickly. And this is replaced by an amendment. Cheyenne?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 561, excuse me, requires the Department of Human Services to submit a report, but this the measure as introduced has been replaced by a -2 amendment. It replaces the content entirely except for retaining the emergency clause and instead requires Oregon Health Authority to plan improved information sharing about youth suicides among local mental health authorities and local systems, requires the plan to address local crisis response, and it suggests partners to that end, requires local mental health authorities to inform Oregon Health Authority within 7 days of a youth suicide what support was provided in the community, and directs OHA to serve as a resource. I believe it's posted for possible work session, but a fiscal has come out on the -2. Fiscal statement is issued, and there's no revenue impact if the committee was inclined to work it today.
Thank you. So, colleagues, this bill was put in as a placeholder to follow up on the youth suicide prevention and intervention coordinator that we created with, I can't remember the bill number now, in the February session last year, just to wait to see what came out. And what this bill is intended to address is that part of what we need is better information, and there's some confusion about how information flows. Really good example of this happened actually in my district just, was it last month or the month before that? There was a youth suicide pact in a middle school. I read about it in the paper. I asked the health authority about it. They hadn't yet heard about it. They called the county mental health authority. They only heard about it by accident because a family had called. The school was not sure that they were allowed to call and let the local mental health authority know that this exists. So what this is intending to do is ensure that there's a clear flow of information from the people that are most likely to know that a youth suicide has taken place, and those are our schools and universities, and work on that process to inform the local mental health authority, who can then inform OHA. And the purpose of that is not just for collecting the data for the report. It will allow appropriate postvention activities to be carried out in the school so that they're able to provide services and information to help prevent that suicide from leading to another suicide in the immediate aftermath of that. Is there anything that the health authority wants to add with that? Do you want to come up for a second? Sorry, Amy.
So, Madam Chair, we had a public hearing on the base bill.
I'm opening up the public hearing.
This is
the public hearing.
Okay. Because so you opened the work session.
Oh, yeah, we did. Okay. Opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 561. Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Amy Baker, and I'm the Child and Family Manager with Addictions and Mental Health, Oregon Health Authority. And Senator Gelser summed this up very correctly, that currently there is a lot of work that gets done between the local mental health authorities and the schools, but it's all in a very organic relationship-based process. And part of what we hope to achieve through the Youth Suicide Strategic and Intervention Prevention Plan is to actually formalize some of those relationships, because we want to ensure that the community has the resources that they need to, one, respond to the the people who are closest to the person who suicided and to prevent other youth from potentially becoming suicidal. There is a real risk of suicide contagion, particularly with youth. So essentially, this allows, it basically states that there is an expectation that this communication will happen, that it's formalized. We intend that to be part of our plan. We have, with the Youth Suicide Strategic and Intervention Plan process, we have the Oregon Department of Education who's participating in that and some of the local school districts. It may look different in each community based on a number of factors, but this will help formalize that process.
Any questions?
Yeah. Well, one of the things we're seeing in some of the timber counties is the counties getting out of mental health business and going to nonprofits. Does that really change the dynamic in any way? I had some concerns with that because some mental health services are delivered, for example, in jails and stuff like that. And I'm, the combination of public and private, I'm a little confused on that. So
I think, and that's a little bit outside of the scope of my authority, Chair Gelser and members of the committee and Senator Cruz, but I can say that the expectations around what a local mental health authority would do, whether it's a private organization or a county, it remains the same in terms of what their response would be to the certain elements of their agreements with us.
Okay. I guess I would assume at this point that the lead authority should probably be with the CCO in many cases, wouldn't it? I mean, to do the coordination.
Chair Gelser, Senator Cruz, that is, so in this particular situation, we're talking about all kids. So we could be about kids with private insurance, no insurance.
Right.
And where we are right now developmentally in the system, CCOs are primarily responsible for their members. And so to ensure that we have a coordinated response to any kid who is either in crisis or, for instance, the school, which could have a myriad of payers who are responsible for the mental health services for those kids, there has to be an entity that is able to respond to everybody.
And that's why this refers to, there's always going to be a local mental health authority. It may be different from community to community, but there will be a mental health authority.
Well, okay, in Douglas County, the county got rid of mental health. It's now being done by a nonprofit, but their jurisdiction is under the CCO. So, I guess I know the dots aren't easy to connect here, because the CCOs are still just glorified Medicaid and really not much more than that. So I guess I'm just trying to figure out who the ultimate authority here should be, because I know in Douglas County the mental health folks are accountable directly to the CCO, and I'm not sure that it's really expanded beyond that at this point, other than just the Medicaid portion of it. So... which is a lot of what the county mental health was. I mean, big chunk of their business is Medicare and Medicaid. We know that. So.
Right. And Senator Cruz, I think those are all really important issues. I think it's beyond the scope of this bill, the way that that's all structured. This really is just about where is that path of information flowing. It's not about where the services are provided. It's just about how does that path of information flow, that there's been a youth suicide. Who do you call?
Madam Chair, I fully understand that, but it's got to connect to where the services are, too, at some point. So, yeah, okay.
Great, thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Baker? Thanks for coming up on the spot. Anybody else want to talk about Senate Bill 561? Seeing none, I'm closing the public hearing on...
Oh, I was getting up.
Okay.
She's a lot.
Rebecca Ross, Sale Morgan, and
There's aspects of this bill that have been talked about today that I hadn't considered, but one of the things that, as I was reading it, that I had considered was that I believe the state is making the definitions of suicide. Is that correct?
No.
No. Okay. So what exactly, I'm concerned about what exactly this does, because we now have the state in charge of our health and the delivery of health and the money for it, and also collecting or being the one that the suicides are reported to. And for instance, like in England, if a person goes to the hospital and they're above a certain age, they will be watched sitting in the room in the lobby for a while, and if it's decided that they shouldn't receive medical care, they might receive a terminal drink. So there's all kinds of problems when the state, which is a power and a is based on force and power, and when our lives are part of the statistics, etc. What concerns me is that the state is centralizing everything, and I appreciate what you're talking about, because we need to have various groups involved so that there's various people involved besides the state.
And this bill is very narrow. It's not changing anything about services to a person who is suicidal. This only kicks in after a person has died. And this is just about how that information gets to the organizations that can provide that support. Okay. In the schools, and it's non-identifying, so there's no personal information, and kind of what happens in England is beyond
the scope. Is this all being lumped together? Like, are suicide jihadists going to be part of this? There's a lot of reasons why there are suicides, and then there are also reasons why a death can be made to look like it's a suicide when it really is a homicide. Is any of that addressed in this whole thing?
So this bill is about when a student that is enrolled in a school.
So it's limited to just students?
It's limited to youth, yes. And it's talking about how the schools in which they're enrolled would notify that a suicide had been completed among their student body. And it's okay. And it's limited to youth, which is up to age 24, and enrolled in a school. So if they're not enrolled in a school, then that wouldn't be the case.
And
I'm happy to talk to you about it more offline. We're running out of time.
Okay,
and we've got
I had
a number
one
of other
more
units.
Question.
Okay,
is the state willing to redo our school system if it shows that the school system itself is the problem? Because the school system itself is one aspect is it's large schools, dispassionate, doing what the centralized government wants. I just went to a hearing on charter schools, and kids who came out of the school system and went into the charter schools were testifying that the environment, the charter school was personable.
And Senator Cruz and I were there. I think that, again, is beyond the scope of the bill. But
right.
The good news is that the good work that's being done around the Youth Suicide Prevention and Intervention Plan is looking at whatever the triggers are that might put a student at risk of suicide, and whatever that might be, I think everyone is committed to making sure that our kids are healthy.
Well, I would really like to encourage you to include the changing of the public school system.
Right. Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Roth. Bill from last February was House Bill 4124. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 561. And are we okay opening a work session on Senate Bill 561? Open a work session on Senate Bill 561.
Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 561 dated 4-8-2015.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 561 dated 4-8-2015. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 561 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 561 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the bill is headed to the floor. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 561.
If you sign it.
Can I carry this one too? I won't carry anymore.
Yes, you will.
What was that one Senator Pazansky was trying to make me carry the other day?
Oh, you didn't get that one? Oh, no, he took it, didn't he?
I think he took it.
That was one of those law...
Like really, oh, really...
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Really good ones. All right. So Senator Shields isn't back yet. So what we're going to do, we've got three bills that we want to have hearings on. I am going to start with... since we're waiting for Senator Shields, I'm going to start with Senate Bill 774. And I'm thanking everybody for being patient. The tax credits took longer than I anticipated in my plan today. So I'm opening up a public hearing. Oh, no, that's what we're here for. We have all the time in the world. Opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 774.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 774 creates a task force on home care commissions staffed by legislative administration. It specifies the composition, the formalities, the object of the task force, authorizes additional paid staff, authorizes pre-session submission of legislation by the task force, requires a report to the legislature, sunsets upon the convening of the 2016 regular legislative session, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact. Again, I believe this is a possible work session today if the committee was inclined. And an indeterminate fiscal, and would warrant a subsequent referral to Ways and Means if it was moved, if the committee was inclined to move.
And I think there may be an amendment that we're going to hear about. So I would invite Katie Coombs, Bobby Soten, and Melissa Unger.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director of SEIU Local 503. Do you want to, if you want to, we can go back and come back.
That's so nice of you.
All
right, thank you. All right, so I'm going to temporarily recess Senate Bill 774, and I'm going to open Senate Bill 909 for the purpose of taking Senator Shields' testimony. Opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 909. Thank you, Melissa.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 909 requires a pre-hiring fitness determination about applicants for direct care positions who have specified criminal histories. Declares
emergency. We're just going to do Senator Shields
passage.
Now, and we'll bring you up when we finish the other hearing. Is that okay?
Sure.
So we can get you back to your hearing. But we will get you up, I promise.
Ready?
Yes, okay. We are ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate District 22. I appreciate you giving some consideration to Senate Bill 909. I also will pass around shortly the testimony of AFSCME that is also in support of the bill. And I know that the chair has worked very diligently on this topic and done some very, very hard work on it. I just wanted to bring this constituent issue forward and just suggest that there still may be some unintended consequences of how we've dealt with this matter in the past. And I think there, particularly in instances where somebody is trying to pursue a promotion, as my constituent will tell you, there may be some unintended consequences to how other agencies are reading the letter of the law, and it might be something that we want to consider. You know, as many of you know, I used to run an outfit called Better People that was a living wage employment and counseling program for people who'd been in trouble with the law. And I've also been a foster parent, so I've kind of worked on both sides of the safety of children issue and seeing the importance of making sure that the punishment not only fit the crime, but fit the person who was involved with the crime. And I just want to kind of jumpstart the conversation again to let the body know that there may be some more work to go here to try to improve the great work that has happened in the bill in the past. So primarily what 909 does is it allows for a fitness determination as opposed to kind of a never-never list of who can work in these kinds of positions. That's one way of looking at it. But really, I just wanted to kind of jumpstart the conversation to say that I think this is still a work in progress, and we might want to figure out ways that we can continue to refine it and improve it.
And I believe that we also have a bill that we passed out of the Judiciary Committee earlier this year that is creating a task force to look at this moving forward to bring back Good. Recommendations. Am I recalling that accurately?
Yeah.
So thank you for your consideration. I'll let my constituents carry from here.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I'm going to temporarily close this public hearing and move back to Senate. So I'm temporarily closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 909. We are going to get back to you, I promise, and reopening the public hearing on Senate Bill 774. The last episode of Senate Bill 774, Melissa Unger was giving her introduction.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director for SEAU Local 503. We actually do have an amendment coming on this bill, and so we're going to be talking about the amendment mainly. So I'm going to turn it over to Katie and Bobby, who's going to give some background, and then I'll go over what the amendment will do.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for your time today. My name is Bobby Soten, and I'm from North Bend, Oregon. And I came here to highlight the importance of Senate Bill 774. We are facing home care workforce shortage here in Oregon, and the problem is only getting bigger as the senior population continues to grow. We should also be looking for ways to simplify the process for new providers coming in the door. To start, I wanted to give you some quick background on the workforce we're talking about. There are around 20,000 workers statewide. And this includes home care workers who provide services for seniors and people with physical disabilities, and personal support workers who provide supports for people with developmental disabilities and mental health issues. This program is a great program because it's consumer directed, and consumers can really hire and fire their workers. Home care and personal support workers provide critical services that allow people to live independently as possible. We provide ADL supports to likely mobility and toileting, IADLs like medication management and meal prep. Some workers provide services for medically fragile children, job coaching, skills, development, supports, etc. Fortunately, right now the system is really soiled between home care workers and PSWs. For instance, if I wanted to provide services to both seniors and people with disabilities and developmental disabilities, I would have to complete a different application and wait to be issued a multiple provider number. Senate Bill 774 helps break down these walls and makes it easier to recruit and train workers across both systems. As I spoke to earlier, there is a growing demand for these services, not enough workers to keep up with the demand. Here in Oregon, we have a registry and referral system where consumers can get matched up with workers. As of February, we only had 59 personal support workers available for work on the registry statewide. This means some consumers who don't know someone and can't get another provider to provide those services. So there is a lot of promise in the registry system, but we need to find ways to make it easier for workers to work across the system. This legislation helps make the process easier for workers to work across the APD and DD system by creating one common application and universal provider number. Breaking down these walls is one of the ways we can start to address the workforce issues we're facing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katie Combs. I'm a field coordinator. I work with SEIU Local 503. I really appreciate your time this afternoon, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 774. I think as we work to address the growing workforce shortages that Bobby talked about, I think we also should be thinking about how home care can be a part of a larger career ladder, and I think that the Senate bill helps address kind of two issues. One, how do we deal with growing workforce shortages, but in doing that in a way that gives workers advancement and development opportunities. So one thing we want to speak a little bit more about is what issues are really driving, like, the workforce challenges we're facing in Oregon. And really, we're at a critical juncture in the need to bring in more workers into the field. Right now, there are, you know, more consumers coming in who need access to the services, and the number of hours needed is also growing. And I don't think that's really going to change, right? Like, here in 2015, we have about 650,000 Oregonians who are age 65 and older. By 2040, that's expected to be $1.1 million. So the need is going to continue to grow. I think another issue driving the need to grow and expand the workforce is the expansion of the Fair Labor Standard Act to home care workers. And what that would do is obviously expand overtime protections to home care workers. And we want to, I think if we want to look to minimize the state's FLSA, like overtime expenses, one of the things we're going to need to do is make sure that there are more workers coming into the system. So if there was any scenario of limiting hours, that there are workers there to pick those up and not creating an unintended consequence around that. And I think it's been estimated that around that we would need to be looking to bring thousands more workers into the system to meet that need. And then I think the final item driving the workforce issue is something that passed in the last session, which was the Home Care Choice Bill, which will expand access to the Home Care Commission program for private pay consumers who will now be able to come in the door that way. And so we want to make sure as that's being moved out and piloted coming this year, that there's also a workforce being developed around there so we aren't creating a strain around for Medicaid consumers and limiting their ability to find somebody because there's competition there. So one of the things that this bill will do is create a task force to look into kind of workforce and recruitment and really figuring out a plan to meet the growing needs. And knowing that home care is a good job, right? It's a good job we want to get people into. How do we also make sure that we're able to develop the right workforce, and especially recruiting young workers so they see it as a way to come in into a career and a first step in doing that. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, again, Melissa Unger for the record. I'm political director for SEIU, Local 503. So the amendment that we're trying to do is really meant to try to address these problems. So the first thing it would do is right now, you can't apply to be a home care worker online. So there's 20,000 workers. The only way to actually become a home care worker is to go and apply in person or have a consumer who applies in person. And that's just not practical in 2015 in the way that people apply for jobs. So the first thing it would do is actually make a universal application for home care workers so that they can apply online and have one application. And in that process, ideally have one kind of enrollment number or provider number that goes along with that application, and it allow people to work across the spectrum. So that's one of the most critical parts of this bill. And we think that actually, in a conversation I was just having the other day, we think that it could go a long way in our recruitment problems is just to solve that one current problem. The second will be that right now people have to, home care workers go through an orientation, and there's oftentimes that workload just make this orientations hard to continue to hold. And so our goal would be, like, what are options where if the orientations have to be closed because of workload or because they just can't happen, we have a backup option that the Home Care Commission could have some kind of orientation that they could offer. So that would be a goal in the bill. And then the third would be to actually look at what's the next step on training and workforce development, and that would include certification. So we're really looking at, like, what maybe we should certify these folks, maybe we shouldn't. But let's have a conversation about it. And Washington and California have both moved to certification over the last couple of years. Washington's actually been in practice. California's passed a bill and is, I think, piloting it. We have there's like upsides and downsides to that. So we actually just want to have a conversation and examine it. Maybe we decide that's not the right thing to go do, but there's certain trainings that we want across the spectrum for all home care workers. And that's the kind of conversation we want to have in that, is like, what's the right training levels? What's the right expectations? And how do we make sure as people come into this job, they see it as a job and that they understand that it can take them somewhere in the next step. So that's the third part of the bill. And then the last part of the bill is actually to dedicate some money to this problem. If we believe that Fair Labor Standards Act will be implemented and that there will be potentially an hour cap about how many hours a worker can work to make sure that we protect the funding and that it doesn't take away from consumers. And to do that, if that happens, the estimate has been that we'll need 2,000 workers. And That's not going to just happen. We're going to actually need to invest some resources into finding those workers, into making sure that they know that this is a job that they want and that we recruit them into it. So the last part of this bill is it really does dedicate some money to the workforce and to developing the workforce and also helping create this career ladder. So those are the four different parts of the amendment that we're hopefully be getting back soon. I know that Elsie was working on it, and it really is to kind of address the shortage. And to be honest, we have over 20,000 workers who do this work. And so what are the things that we can do now to invest in them to make sure that that can be continue to be a good job as this field grows? So those are the things that the bill will do, and we appreciate the time today.
Do you know when you might expect that amendment back?
We were hoping today. So I think soon. So I think we're working on it. They have all the language, so we're hoping soon. And we'll follow up with Lori and C2, but I do think we're hoping soon.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for this panel?
I don't have a question, Madam Chair, but I really like the way this bill is headed. You know, and I think the elements related to creating sort of career pathways for these workers, I think is really important. And this is, as you say, just going to be, a really growing kind of field. And, the current home care world that's, mainly Medicaid-focused, but, as it opens to the larger population, I think the Home Care Commission is and can be a real resource. But, I think we really have to look at its structure. We have to look at just how it does its work, how it interacts with the counties, et cetera. So I think this is very, very timely.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 774 and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 909 and invite Bruce Lloyd and Jill Williams back up. Thank you for your patience. And we have an extra person.
Yeah.
Thank you. And Jill, why don't you go ahead and start?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the opportunity to speak here today. And for the record, I'm here today as a private citizen and in no way representing my employer, which is Multnomah County, or any other entity, just here for myself. I'd like to start with just telling you something that happened to me a long time ago in 1991. My college boyfriend, Kevin, died in an auto accident. It was his 23rd birthday, and we had been off campus at a bar with friends. Kevin had a jealous drink when he drank, and that night he was drinking heavily. At midnight, I dropped him off at his place and decided to go home myself as I didn't want to continue arguing and I didn't want to spend the night with him. Furious that I was leaving, Kevin jumped onto the hood of my car and smashed my windshield. I continued to drive, and two blocks later, he fell off my car. He died later that night from head injuries. And because we had been drinking and I had been behind the wheel, I was later charged and pled guilty to vehicular manslaughter. I was ordered to 4 years of probation. I had to pay a fine to the court. I was ordered to receive counseling due to the trauma, and I was assigned to perform 1,200 hours of community service. Half of the hours were spent caring for patients at a Catholic Charities hospice, and when the hospice offered me full-time employment, I did the remaining hours at a domestic violence shelter. Both of these agencies were supportive of me and knew in detail about the accident and about my guilty plea. I went on to graduate school in 1996, and in 1998, I moved to Portland. For 2 years, I worked in Clackamas County, providing direct services to children and families with small children who had histories of child abuse and neglect. During this time, I also volunteered with Willamette Hospice. I visited dying patients in their homes. Both of these places had run criminal checks on me and made a fitness determination. They decided to hire me despite my horrible experience in 1991. In 2000, I was hired as a long-term care case manager with Multnomah County Aging and Disability Services. And for the next 12 years, I worked in North Portland doing cognitive and physical assessments of low-income Medicaid seniors and people with disabilities. These assessments were done in their homes. Again, my criminal history had been disclosed, and I had been deemed fit to work in this capacity. In 2012, in part to my good reputation as a case manager, I was chosen for a limited duration promotion to run a 2-year pilot project. I was asked to identify service gaps and trends in over and under system utilization. I also provided direct intensive case management with high-risk clients. During the pilot, I worked closely with Adult Protective Services. And when my pilot ended in 2014, I applied for and was offered a permanent position with this protective service team. Since the two-year pilot program had been a limited duration and temporary promotion, no new criminal check was required. But for the permanent position, again, I filled out the disclosure and had my fingerprints sent to Salem. For 23 years, I had disclosed this event from 1991, and for 23 years, approximately 8 different agencies approved me for volunteering or for paid hire through a fitness determination process. I suppose my otherwise clean record, reference checks, education and employment history, as well as the circumstances of my crime, were all taken into consideration. The check done in 2014, however, came back to my HR department as ineligible. ORS 443-004 had gone into effect 2 years earlier. The way in which it's written allowed no fitness determination, and it clearly listed some crimes, including mine, as being permanently exempt from hire or promotion. My initial reaction was shock and disbelief. My HR team was not familiar with the new law, and they agreed to look into it. I also called my union, who tried to find a way to help me. I hired an employment attorney who picked apart the letter of the law to find some way to spare me the job. Nothing seemed likely. I was not willing to give up. I called Senator Shields' office and asked for help. I'm very lucky that my employer was able to keep me employed by demoting me back to my original case management position for which I was hired in 2000. I've heard other stories about people being fired from other agencies. For me, being told at the age of 45 that I can never seek promotion and I can never apply for another job in my field in the state of Oregon, it was very difficult to hear. I have 20 years left that I expect to work in this field. I love my community and my state. I love my employer. I've finally paid off student loans. I love social work. I don't want to start at the bottom of a new field or move to another state in order to progress in my current one. The scar that had been fairly healed was torn apart again while going through all of this. I was reliving Kevin's death every day and experiencing being punished all over again for my role in what had happened so long ago. It's been an emotionally difficult and financially expensive past year for me. After several months and thousands of dollars in attorney fees in both Oregon and Maryland, I was finally able to present DHS background check unit overwhelming evidence, including the original certified docket sheet from 1992, which explains that my guilty plea was a condition of a probation before judgment. So technically, I do not have a conviction. Their decision about my eligibility for promotion was eventually reversed, but unfortunately, my position had been filled, and I remain in my original case management as of this date. The background check unit cannot guarantee me that I won't have to fight the same battle again if and when I apply for another promotion. In closing, I'd like to say that I do understand the intent behind the law. I've worked with vulnerable populations for 20 years, and I've worked with Adult and Child Protective Services and testified in abuse and neglect cases. I've seen predatory caregivers take advantage of my clients, and I have personal experience as well. My father's bedridden with multiple sclerosis, and over the years, he's had a dozen or more personal care aides. There have been two that we have come to find out later had mistreated and stolen from him. Both were fired, and we involved the police. What their records look like now, I don't know, but I know at the time that they were hired, they had clean records, and I don't think my father was their first victim. They just hadn't been caught. Neither of them did jail time or paid restitution. I also have a 14-year-old nephew with severe autism. Henry lives with my brother and sister-in-law, but he has respite caregivers. Because Henry is nonverbal, interviews with the caregivers are carefully done so that references can be checked. His parents spend a lot of time getting to know his caregivers. Sadly, because they have simply passed a background check does not guarantee us that they are all fit. It is also true that simply because I failed to pass a background check under 443-004 doesn't indicate that I'm unfit as a social worker or abuse investigator. There are other factors that are just as relevant in making this decision to hire or promote. Please consider Senator Shields' Bill 909 and allow the background check unit and hiring agencies a proper fitness determination or some sort of weighing test when reviewing applications and criminal background histories. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, and I will need your name because I don't have you.
Jim.
Oh, no, I've got yours.
Okay. Oh, Bruce Lloyd.
Oh, you are Bruce Lloyd. Okay.
Yes, I'm Bruce
Lloyd. Got your name.
I hope so, Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here to address 909 from the perspective. I'm a retired caseworker. I have had extensive career with Multnomah County Aging and Disability Services myself. And a lot of my experience has to do with home care workers, especially I worked in the Northeast Portland Office of Aging and Disability Service Office. And there were a lot of prospective caregivers that were disqualified because of minor infractions they might have had when they were young and dumb. And it was everything from prostitution to just possession of marijuana to just simple, you know, illegal possession of alcohol. But they happened when they were young, and yet 20 years later, they were being disqualified when they would apply. And a lot of times it was for family members or other members of the community that I was having a hard time finding caregivers for.
And on what basis? Because those in the law that's referenced in that, none of those are convictions that are covered by that. Minor in possession, prostitution.
Yeah, well, but I don't know. They were disqualified. That's all I can say is. So, how about shoplifting, some of the other, you know, theft, petty theft when they were young. But I think, though, that there is the reason for the fitness determination. I certainly support that. But what I want to just say is I think that there needs to be a lot of consideration. It needs to be subjective as far as when it took place, the severity, and whether or not it looks like they're repeaters. So I think those are the types of factors that need to be taken into consideration. And I think especially in respect to what the previous persons testifying were talking about, the shortage of caregivers that's going to be pending. You know, with the need to expand, I think there does need to be a little bit more of subjective investigation into again, you know, how recent was the crime? Does it have to do with addiction? Does it have to do with the person's redemption, possibly? So, you know, I'll keep my – I didn't write anything, so I'm sorry. I'll keep mine short and sweet and end my testimony there.
Thank you very much.
All right. My name's Travis Pugh. So I'd like to address you guys, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. So my story is actually, you might be familiar with it. I take care of my sister who was born with Angelman syndrome, actually. And it's a really rare diagnosis. Many people don't know about it, but it causes her to have tremors and seizures and others of such. Well, when I was in college, my freshman year in college, I went to a party and I actually ended up, we were drinking. I left the house with a shot glass. Well, 14 people got arrested for taking things from the house and everything else. Well, they tried us in joint. So I got a burglary one charge for theft of a shot glass. However, I ended up taking a plea deal for a burg two. And under that deal, you know, I was told, okay, it's expungible. I didn't think anything of it. I was like, yeah, okay, I'll take the deal. You know, it sounds good. No jail time, no whatever else. Well, I went through a hardship. I was initially denied to be a care provider for my sister. I went through a hardship and went through everything, you know, submitted saying I'm still going to take care of her regardless. You know, it's my sister and she needs all the attention she can. Not many people are able to maneuver her. She's getting pretty big. So, you know, it's, you don't find many guys that are able to do everything and take care of her. So I went through a hardship. I actually ended up getting approved to be her full-time care provider. So that was in 2010. So when the new law went into effect, I was terminated immediately from watching my sister, which, like I said, I was still going to take care of her regardless. It's my sister and everything else. But financially, you know, I wasn't expecting it. It was one of those things I didn't see coming at all. So to me, it's like I understand there's new bills being put into place and new laws, and that's great. But I think it should go by, you know, each case should be looked into further and everything else, because I know how it impacted me personally, financially, and knowing that, you know, my parents, you know, having to go out and find a new care provider for my sister and someone they trust to bring in and stuff like that. And especially, like I said, most providers are females, so it's hard for them to be able to do certain things and stuff like that. And it's, as a guy, I'm having to provide for my sister and do everything that needs to be done that way that most guys wouldn't be able to do. So I just know personally how the law affected me and the new bill and how it should be looked at.
And I think if I remember when we went and worked on your case, that we found that there had been an error at DHS at that initial hiring, because prior to the bill, when it passed, grandfathered in everybody that was already working for a client, but they hadn't done that.
Like, it wasn't even a year before that I had applied. They had an error, apparently.
Yeah.
But I initially I was denied of hire, and then I went through the hardship
right.
and everything to get. I mean, I have it all taken care of
right.
now.
Because you've now gotten expunged,
I
right?
got expunged. I have everything taken care of. I'm just here to say that each case, you know, I know personally how it affected me and how each case should be looked at completely individually instead of as a whole broad perspective.
Well, thank you all so much for coming. Are there brief questions for this panel? We've got one more big bill to get to. Anybody? Is there anybody else that wants to be heard? Thank you all so much for taking time to come and for being patient with the back and forth and for sharing your stories. I know those are hard things to get up and talk about in a room full of strangers and on the internet. Thank you, Senator Shields.
Yep, Madam Chair, I do have a question about
yes.
it. Actually, this is a question to you. So you had mentioned that there's another bill that's going to deal with this, and could you speak to that?
Yes, so there's a bill that came out of the Judiciary Committee, and it will Melissa, would you mind being put on the spot to come up and talk about this other bill?
No.
Why, thank you.
I'd love to be put on the spot. So, Senator Chair Gelser and Senator DeMarco, so that bill actually hasn't moved yet, Senate Bill 602. And the goal was to look at a task force, and we're currently working to figure out. There's a similar bill that was created last session, so there's a couple different conversations happening around this right now. So we're still trying to figure out where all of those conversations are, because it's important to us to continue to look at what are the options for review of the law and how it is impacting people. So that's our goal right now.
And will you state your name again?
Oh, sorry, Melissa Unger, SEIU Local 503. Sorry about that.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Yes, Senator Olson?
So this bill requires a fitness determination. Does this bill allow them to say, okay, you've been convicted, but we'll still allow you to work? Is that what this bill does?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Olson.
It does, Madam Chair, if I'm not mistaken. It allows them to weigh different factors. Right? I mean, they do a weight test kind of thing.
They do a weight test. The issue and the concern that I have is that I think it's a conversation we need to keep having. And since we passed this law in 2009, I know you have and I have kind of chased down different things to try to figure out where there are issues. Most of the time, there are issues where there was an error in human services. This is the first one that I've heard. I mean, that's a really compelling story that we just heard about the driver. But prior to the passage of that bill, that's what it was. It was a fitness determination. And partly because of the workforce shortage, there was a lot of pressure to approve folks that may not be there. And we had 1 in 4 individuals with developmental and intellectual disabilities that were experiencing significant abuse. And so it was all part of that abuse package. So I'm much more comfortable moving forward with something in a vehicle like what Melissa has brought forward that would have representatives of people that are receiving care, self-advocates, and representatives of workers really looking at the information of what's happening, what are the convictions that are popping up. Even this list is far narrower. We were really careful when we did it in 2009. It's much narrower than what applies to school teachers. For instance, it's a much, much narrower pool of issues. And we had one. I brought a bill last session to remove theft one, because that was one that seemed to pop up a lot, and we couldn't get that across the floor.
And Chair Gelson, Senator DeMarco, just one quick note is so what we're trying to track down and get more information on is there has been some conversations around what are the appropriate different things for different classifications of folks, and so we're trying to get a handle on what have those conversations been like, who have been at those tables, and kind of track all that down. So I do think there is some interest in continuing the conversation and figuring out what the right conversation is and where we go from
right.
there.
And I share that interest in continuing that conversation. I just don't think we've completed the conversation enough yet to switch all the way back to a fitness determination for everything as opposed to the background check.
And your amendment will be out when?
Well, this
different bill.
So yes, sorry.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, Madam Chair, because I remain very interested in this issue, and I'm less concerned about the crime as the process by which, you know, the individual is analyzed, you know, their fitness for the particular job.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 909. And now...
Chris?
Yes. And now I'm going to, we've done everything except for 226, right? So I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 226. You'll recall that we opened up the public hearing on this the other day to indicate that we were going to stuff this bill. I had hoped the amendments would be back by now. They do not yet exist.
Good.
But they are submitted, and people can come up and talk about them.
Matt and Randy really quick, too.
Of course.
What are we talking about?
Yeah, who knows?
Senate Bill 226. Backside. And it has nothing to do with what that says anymore. This is the new SACU bill.
Yeah, that's what I forgot about us. Getting stuff.
What?
I almost thought you forgot.
Chair Gelson.
Sorry, doing our best.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you very much for taking the or giving us the opportunity to talk about the proposed amendments for Senate Bill 226. I almost said a different number completely. My name is Eva Ripto. I am political coordinator for AFSCME Council 75, and I have with me Matt Orser, who is Local 1246 president, representing SACU direct care workers, and Randy Ritterbush, who's the staff representative. As you probably know, that Matt and Randy have been in the building a lot to talk about issues at the Stabilization and Crisis Unit homes that are run by the Department of Human Services. And we really appreciate having this bill to and the proposed amendments to deal with some of the issues that they've been talking about. So I'll let Matt go ahead and take it from here.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Orser for the record. We have 550 employees of the DHS, Stabilization Crisis Unit. Over the last several years, the members of the Local 1246 have come to legislate asking for additional staffing and for help to address the needs associated with the changing levels of the clients that we serve. We appreciate the work and the attention that the issue is now receiving. Crisis Outreach Assessment Team and Task Force that we're talking about today is looking at other solutions of help to improving our safety for our individuals and staff. We do have a higher level of individuals. I'm not sure if a lot of you remember Fairview, but that's where I come from, where more of our individuals are more intellectually challenged than our individuals that we're getting now, which are PSRBs and 827s with a more higher function, a level of street smarts. How would I put it that way? Just break it down. Street smarts they're coming into that we're not accustomed to. So with this that we're looking at, this SB 226 would really help us out with this crisis outreach, that we'd have somebody that would come in and help when we're getting people that are coming out of the county jails or the state hospital that we're receiving now. We would have them as a backup team that, so a case violence or any issue did occur with the new individual coming in, we have a backup plan versus our staff being hurt. And I know you guys know that we've had a lot of staff hurt over the years due to the changing level of individuals that we are now serving. So in all that, I don't want to go on too long, but we're hopeful that the task force we'll be able to bring back solutions that will help keep the clients and staff safe and learn to support the changing face of SACU clients. We are very appreciative of the addition of the SACU direct care staff and representatives. They know first hand what we need to improve the success of SACU and moving their clients to the community setting. Ask me and the locals all are in favor of this. It's been a long day. Sorry, guys.
You're doing great. And we made you
I was in other meetings before here, so I apologize if I'm stumbling over words. I've got other things. But we appreciate you guys listening to us, and hopefully we can take this forward and make this happen for the better of everybody.
And would it be okay if just for the committee, because I have the proposal in front of me. Can I tell you all what we're talking about doing?
Sure.
So is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Even so the request that we put forward, and we've had a number of meetings. Eva has worked particularly hard on this as the Council on Developmental Disabilities, Disability Rights Oregon, the Department of Human Services. There have been countless conversations with all of you guys. And so the agreement, and it looks like all of the involved entities are okay with this. the amendment would replace 226 altogether, and it would direct the Department of Human Services to create three regional crisis outreach assessment teams to serve the 23 residential facilities known as the SACU, and each of them would have a dedicated state vehicle to allow for immediate crisis response. And the duties of these COAT teams would be limited to on-site crisis stabilization and crisis response, on-site staffing support, intervention, and education, on-site debriefing of critical incidents, staff redeployment when client ratios are under acceptable levels, crisis outreach assessment and consultation with referring agencies, and client advocacy and education with law enforcement, corrections, PSRB, and district attorneys. In addition to that, the bill would create the Task Force on Client and Staff Safety. And, you know, it's got all the people that would be appointed, and they include members of the legislature, three representatives that are direct workers in the SACU, two representatives from AFSCME. We'll say something different in the bill. One representative of the Oregon Health Authority that has, and this is really important, expertise providing mental health services to individuals that are duly diagnosed with mental health and intellectual disabilities, an individual representing individuals living in the SACUs or their families, a DRO person, a person from the Council on Developmental Disabilities, the director of the DHS DD program, and the director of the SACU, and something that isn't added in yet, but it was recommended that we have someone from the community group homes and someone that does the transition back out. And they would be looking at, consider and make recommendations about issues including but not limited to ensuring the dignity and self-determination of each client served, improving the safety of staff, improving appropriate training and support for staff, including staffing levels, reducing incidents of aggressive and assaultive behavior in the SACU, reducing the number of injuries for clients and staff, reducing the use of overtime, and improving access to appropriate mental health supports and intervention for SACU clients. And that last piece is really key, because right now there are no qualified mental health professionals that are available to the folks in the SACU. There's a significant need there. And I did pull together Erin Kelly Seal and Lynn Saxton. We talked about this issue on a broader level. And part of the hope is that through these COAT teams, as we're developing this expertise of that intersection between mental health and intellectual disability, that we can start to create that capacity in the community as well, which would hopefully prevent as many people from going into crisis and needing to go to the SACU. If we have fewer people in the SACU, there will be more flexibility to move people around, have better match among clients instead of having clients that escalate each other and create more complications and tension. So that's what the bill will do.
And it comes down to, that's what it really comes down to, is the placement aspect of it. Because when, like what you're saying, when we've got a house that we've got everybody in a stable, what we consider stable as floor staff, and then we bring in somebody out of the street who totally disrupts, what it does is it pushes everybody back 2 years back from the progress right. They had to go out into the private sector. And that's a big key thing, is that placement issue. So I'm glad that you guys are addressing the placement issue too.
Well, I'll say a little bit. You did most of it for me. My name's Randy Ritterbush. I'm the staff rep for these folks. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the time like everybody else. One of the keys is the emergency placements, and that's the only piece that I think that isn't in the description that's important to note, that these folks get clients that are out in the community, in jails, that are in terrible crises, and they don't have time to plan. These COAT teams would give us the ability and the extra staff to make sure when they enter the home, they aren't disrupting the rest of the people's lives. I also want to mention that this is really just part of the overall process. Recently, I met with Erin Kelly Seeley in the governor's office, and we said, look, we're not on the same page. We got to get on the same page. We're actually bargaining. We've suspended bargaining, and we've went into kind of an interest-based work session, and this is part of that plan. And we've talked about a way to fund these new positions and the COAT team with the reduction of the overtime costs. So this really should not be the $2.5 million right. that this is going to cost the general fund should really come out of the overtime savings. The agency right now is projecting $7.4 million in overtime costs for this year. The plan that we put together, which would put an additional 120 staff, 25 managers, and 101 staff, would cost the general fund, if it was to be new money, $5.6 million, which is a lot less than $7.4 million in the overtime. So what we're trying to do with the agency is rearrange it, and totally redo the organization, which we have done, and make it smaller,
we're calling them islands, but they're not, like three of the homes. And the idea is to make those homes work together, have the staff be a little more portable, work together to make these groupings of homes the place where we look at how we place the people. So one set of homes may take a certain type of clients, and the staff would be used to working with those clients, and we'd be able to move the staff with the clients. It's really a joint effort, and this is an important piece of that, and we implore you to move this forward. And the task force is an important part of it, but I'm really feeling good about the work we're doing together now and feel like we're putting a task force together ourselves. But that, we need it. We need to look at the whole program.
Well, and I'm just so appreciative of everybody. I know this has historically been a very difficult topic. I know it it causes a lot of emotion and anxiety for everybody that is involved, because it's about safety. It's about a very high stress atmosphere for everyone. And I have just so appreciated the last couple of months seeing conversations happen that haven't happened in the past. And that's really required a lot of people suspending belief and really trusting, kind of giving everybody the benefit of the doubt. And I think the result of that is I think we're going to have a good product. And I think we've moved through some barriers in the conversation to, even outside of this bill, be able to move forward to a better place for the people that are working in the SACUs, the people that are living in the SACUs, and hopefully out in the community, keeping people from ever having to go in the first place to that more restrictive environment.
And Madam Chair, I think it's important to recognize it's also to help the community.
Yeah.
We are out in the community and we need to protect everybody. The client's needs are obviously the most important, and that's why we exist. But and the staffing needs are important. But as you know, the community is at risk too, as we've seen in the last 2 years. So this is good for everybody in the state of Oregon.
Madam Chair, I was just curious if DHS has shared their stabilization and crisis unit proposal for the crisis outreach assessment teams with the.
I think that may be what the draft was.
Okay.
Put together based on.
Yeah, I'm happy to share it with the committee.
Okay, that would be great.
And we'll add the plan that is hot off the press today with the costing that I was just talking about. And we'll get you a cleaner copy once they come out in color.
Great. Any further questions? So as soon as the amendments are back, we will get them out to everybody and we'll get them posted up on OLIS. So we'll probably set this so people have time to read them for next Thursday, a week from today. Yeah. So I'm just asking, will you post it for next Thursday,
yes,
a week from today? Great. Thank you all very
much. Thank you very much.
And just for the record, part of the conversation, the development of the bill has been, AFSCME has been part of this conversation. The Department of Human Services has been at this conversation before submitting the amendment request that would make the bill. It kind of ran through everybody at the department, in the advocacy community, and AFSCME. And we've been careful to avoid any issues that are subjects of bargaining. So we're not putting anything in the task force or the work that's the subject of bargaining. Thank you very much. Anything? Oh, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 226. Colleagues, we got a lot done today. Thank you all for sticking with it and asking good questions. And I'm especially grateful for the things going on the record around the tax credits. Please look at, and I'm going to check in with each of you about the bill we held over, the kind of business child care tax credit, as well as the expansion of the crop
Senate Bill 48 donation. And Senate Bill 760.
Yes, and then 659, when we get the amendment back, that should be ready to go. And then we'll also get out to you that 774 amendment as soon as we get that back. And with that, we are adjourned.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes. Adjourned.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.